Well, here we are, the end of August, almost the exact end of August, and it's a great time of the year in the garden, isn't it? And we've had some, I think, some pleasant weather out there, and I don't know how many BLTs I've had, but I've had a lot of bacon, lettuce, and tomato sandwiches recently. Having a lot of fun with that. Larry Mueller here. Welcome to another edition of Garden Talk on the Ideas Network. Today we're going to be talking about summer gardens, summer garden cleanup maybe a little bit, what you can do to get rid of any diseases your gardens might have. Our guest, Diana Alfeth, is great. She's a horticulture educator with UW Extension in Pierce County. She also teaches landscape design at UW River Falls. She joins us from our Eau Claire studios. Diana, thank you for taking time to be with us today.
Absolutely. It's always great to be here, Larry.
Oh, it's so much fun to have you on. And this is, I got a fun time in the garden, isn't it?
Well, it is because, you're in the peak of harvest and that kind of a thing. But by this point, some people are kind of getting tired of gardening, too, believe it or not, because, we have had a lot of rain in a lot of parts of the state this year. And so while that's really been great, we haven't had to, put the sprinklers on and all of that stuff. We've also been, the other side of that is we've been mowing and mowing and mowing, and those weeds have also had a banner year. So by this point, if you get behind on those weeds, it's kind of hard to catch up. And so I hate to say it, but there are some people who are kind of looking for that first, I hate to say the word. It's kind of the swear word of gardeners, the F word, frost.
Yes. And, well, I've got most of my garden is in a straw bales, so I don't have any weeding to worry about and all that.
I saw the picture that you just posted up on Facebook this morning of your straw bale garden, and that looks like it's doing great. I'm not sure how the plastic turkey got the name Margaret, though.
Well, I think that was daughter Emily again. She comes up with names. We've got...
Is she the one that named Limey, lime tree?
She named Limey, and she named Margaret. So,
And how is Limey doing, anyway?
Limey's had a tough summer. Limey is, and I've got to put Limey in a bigger pot, I think. Uh-huh. Limey has three limes at present growing in various stages of light. But there's also, Limey, she's outside right now, but there's a little black stuff on the underside of a couple of her leaves that I'm going to have to look at this weekend, and I'm not sure what that is.
Well, and it's, very likely it's some kind of fungal thing going on, and that's the other side with all this rain that we've had, especially, in my neck of the woods, western Wisconsin. There's only been a couple of times all summer that we've gone more than 5 days without rain. So we've had a lot of moisture, which means a lot of wet leaves, and I keep track of that because I, grow hay and put up hay. So we, really watch for those dry spells. And it's hard to find a plant that doesn't have spotted leaves or blotches on leaves or something fuzzy and gray growing on it, because the fungus among us has been really, really happy with all of this moisture as well. So that might be what Limey has, is something, if it's black and on the underside of the leaves, that'd be my first thing to think about.
Yeah. Well, Limey and I are going to have a little talk this weekend. I'm going to give her a little going over, and we'll find out what's going on.
And especially before, you bring Limey in for the winter and stuff, you always want to make sure that anything, things don't come in along with it. So, if it's black, there's always a possibility that it's insect eggs of some kind or something like that, too. So you want to make sure any house plants like Limey or anything else that you've been summering out on the patio for the year gets a good going over before it comes in.
I will do that. And, Cheryl in Menominee called and has a question for you. That's an interesting one, I think. Cheryl, hi. Thank you for calling.
Hi. Thank you. I'm volunteering at the Red Cedar Depot right now, and I listen to your show every Friday at this time.
Thank you.
And I have a question. I moved here from Connecticut, and it's a rented house because I have dogs, and my daughter's a professor at Stout. And so I bought three pumpkin plants from Fleet Farm and two tomato plants. I the pumpkins, I planted them in sun alongside a real sunny spot and watered them. And they grew really well, and I have beautiful orange flowers. But not one little pumpkin. Not one. Not even one that died.
No.
Okay.
And then the second thing is I had, three tomato plants, and one was doing really well, and then we had a huge rain. And the very next day, it all just, it wilted and died. So I guess it got tomato blight that fast.
Well, so let's talk about the pumpkins first. If they got a lot of flowers and never got fruit, chances are that was a pollination problem.
That's right. I was thinking that, yep.
Yeah, and so whether the bees weren't hanging out there, that kind of a thing, you know, it's hard to say. If it's in the sun, you should have bees.
Yeah, I have bees in my, at my bird feeders, at my hummingbird feeders. I mean, I have bees in the yard.
Yeah. Yeah, and unfortunately, you know, at this point in time, even if you did get a baby pumpkin, it's too late for it to mature into anything. But typically, if you get flowers and no fruit, it's a pollination issue one way or another. So some people will go out there, you know, just in case the bees don't do their jobs, they'll go out there with a little paintbrush and do some hand pollination just to ensure that you get some pumpkins. So if you try it again next year, you might try that. Once you start, you have to look at the flowers and make sure which ones are males and female flowers. On these vine crops, there can be males and females. And the females will have a little swelling at the base, and that's the precursor to what's going to be the pumpkin. And so if you take a little paintbrush and you go from the male flowers and you just dust it, and then you dust the female flowers, you know, that will do the pollination that the bees are supposed to do, but, you know, the bees don't always, you know, read the instructions.
The
yeah. And we can't know why they didn't visit your pumpkin flowers. And then on your tomatoes, the thing that I would be concerned with is if you had a heavy rain and then the plant wilted the very next day.
I go out there every morning and this one was doing growing really big and good. In fact, I still have one little tomato that's getting ripe on my porch. It's a tiny one, but it was doing really well. And then the very next day I went out after we had this huge rain. In fact, I had 2 inches in my rain collector. And the tomato plant was wilting. And I picked those leaves off, and then it just kept wilting and died.
Yeah. My guess is if it looked fine one day and it was wilting after a storm is that maybe it got whipped around in the storm and the stem was damaged, and then everything was hanging there wilting. If you get tomato blight, whether it's early blight or late blight, you're going to have spots and blotches and brown globs and stuff like that on the leaves themselves. So if it was wilting the next day and just kind of like getting limp, that sort of thing, my guess would be that the stem got damaged somehow and that blocked the transport of moisture from the roots up to the top of the plant and that started the decline of it. So, you know, and if it's growing in a container, you know, it's kind of up there, it could get blown around and wind that goes along with those storms, or even just the heavy rain can kind of beat it down if it's raining hard enough to, damage some of the stems and stuff. Yeah. So that might have been what happened there. We have had, lots of fungus around this year with all the rain, especially in western Wisconsin. And we have had late blight in St. Croix County, which I think this was the first year that we've had confirmed cases of it. But early blight on tomatoes got started way early this year with all the rain. And then we've had a lot of cases of late blight around the state as well. But that even that's going to take, it's going to show up as brown spots and blotches on the leaves and then on the fruit as well. But it's going to, take more than overnight for that to set in.
Yeah, there we go. Thanks a lot for calling, Cheryl. Appreciate your call. I want to give Roger in Deer Park, Illinois, a chance to join in. Roger, hi, thank you for calling.
I'm a nature photographer. I taught classes at Harper College on photography. And for lack of flowers in our area, even in the forest reserves, I decided to do my own garden, flower garden. So I started about 5 years ago. I get a lot of my flowers from prairie nursery, and I have 6 giant clusters of bee bomb flowers, 3 different species. pink, red, and bright red. And what's happening is we don't get much rain down here, by the way. We'll go 10 days without rain this summer.
Okay.
Terrible. So anyway, I'm getting this powdered mildew, and on the internet it says you can use skim milk, a 1-to-9 ratio, and spray it on the leaves, and it's supposed to get rid of it, and it didn't do anything for them. In fact, it seemed like it harmed some of these plants. And I want to tell you, these plant clusters are like 6 to 8 feet wide and about 6 feet deep and over 5 feet high. They're huge. I've never had them that large before.
And there we've got powdery mildew from the sound of it.
Right. And bee balm is very susceptible to powdery mildew. Most varieties are. And powdery mildew is a fungus, but it's a little bit different than other fungus, because a lot of other fungus likes wet leaves where there's actually wet, you know, water on the leaves from dew or rain or whatever. Powdery mildew actually likes hot, humid conditions without actual raindrops falling on the leaves. And quite honestly, I think all bee balm that's susceptible to powdery mildew gets it every year, no matter what the weather conditions are. But once you see the white stuff on the leaves, it's actually kind of too late to do much about it, because with fungus, our fungicides, whether it's an organic option like trying the skim milk or baking soda or a chemical option, are really protectants. So they need to be on the leaves before the fungus takes hold. So they don't cure fungus, but they help prevent it. So what you have is a plant with this bee balm that's very susceptible to powdery mildew. You should expect to have it every year. So if you want to prevent that, you should treat it before you start seeing the white fuzzy stuff on there. So by mid to late June, you should be putting on the treatment. Now, skim milk, the milk thing has been out there. There's different evidence on how effective it is. There's also a baking soda mix that you can do with baking soda, some horticultural oil, some water, and spray that on. Or there are chemical fungicides. And, whichever ones you want to try is fine. That's up to you. But try to... The good news is that powdery mildew on the leaves isn't going to kill your plants. It's typically a foliar thing, and the root system is just fine. It'll come back next year just fine. But next year, try to start spraying that stuff on them when the leaves are coming up before you start seeing symptoms, and then you'll, hopefully be preventing it from getting there in the first place.
There you go. Thanks a lot for calling, Roger. Appreciate your call. And we finally have some open lines again. You can join us at 1-800-642-1234. You can email us at talk@wpr.org or post on our Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. And if you've got a garden photo, I posted one of my straw bale garden this morning. If you have one, go to The Larry Mueller Show Facebook page. Post it right there. I'm Larry Mueller. Brandy Funk, our on-air producer here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Next time on Garden Talk, next week, we're talking about lawn care. Doug Soldat will be along to talk about that. Right now, though, visiting with Diana Alfath, the horticulture educator for UW Extension in Pierce County, teaches landscape design at UW River Falls as well, and it's great to have her along to talk about later summer in the garden. And questions for her, give us a call at 1-800-642-1234. Email at talk@wpr.org or post on our Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. And Brandy's letting me know right now. I have to take a look at our Facebook page. I think she says there's lots of nice pictures on our visitor posts on Facebook. So go take a look. Go take a look. Let's go to Sally in Middleton next. Sally, hi. Thanks a lot for calling. Sally, are you there?
Yes, hello.
Hi, what can we do for you?
I appreciate this opportunity because I had this question ever since our severe winter, record-breaking cold that passed half a year ago. I'm amazed how much greenery, I thought half of the vegetation would be dead from that, just be frozen to their roots. But on the contrary, my backyard looks like a jungle.
Actually, Sally, last winter wasn't It was the winter before that was really bad, if I'm remembering correctly. Diana?
Yep, that's right. The winter before was really long, and we had a lot of cold, but we also had a lot of snow. And so the ground really didn't freeze the ground always freezes, but it freezes to, you know, maybe 27, 28 degrees. It's the years where we have a lot of cold but no snow that the ground will freeze down to 23, 24 degrees, maybe 22. And that's when we get damage to plants because it kills the root system. So the good news with that winter, was that we had a lot of snow cover that also helped insulate the ground so it didn't freeze super, super cold. So we didn't have, horrible root damage. And so the plants recovered. We did have a lot of winter burn that year because the above ground parts of the plants were exposed to that cold. They were exposed to a lot of wind, and they were exposed to it for a long period of time. So we had a lot of damage that way. We also had some damage. We're still seeing symptoms of that winter on apple trees, especially up in our area here, because the vascular system, the trunks and stuff, the cells in the trunks and branches had some damage, and that takes a long time for the plants to recover from, or that sometimes they can't ever recover from the extent of the damage. But the root systems made it through that winter pretty well because of that nice, horrible snow shoveling we had to do all that year.
There you go. And, you know, if you don't have, if the roots aren't killed, the plants are, and you get a nice spring with the right moisture and sunshine, you're going to get, it's going to come, the vegetation comes back pretty quick.
Right. And we, you know, like I said, the above ground parts took a hit. And, you know, that first year we had some, less flowers on some things because flower buds were killed because of the cold and stuff like that. But the root zones, like I said, the worst winters are the ones where we get all that cold, but we don't have the snow to help insulate the soil.
Sally, thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate it. Doreen in Wisconsin Rapids, on to you now. Hi, Doreen.
Hi, thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I have a question about a tomato that is potted. We've gardened for many years, and I have many tomatoes out in the garden, but I have one in a large pot this year because I wanted to put it in our new little greenhouse at the end and hopefully keep it going. And the problem that I have is that at first we thought it was getting early blight like our other tomatoes, but my husband sprayed it. We do use a copper sulfate type spray on that, and it doesn't seem to be that. We had blossom end rot, and hopefully I've corrected that. We forgot to put lime in the pot, but I'm wondering if the leaves that are dying down below, and we have some little brown spots on the top, could be another mineral deficiency we weren't thinking of in a pot, because our other tomatoes don't have this at all.
Okay. Well, I'd probably not look towards a mineral deficiency as the first issue there. Growing things in containers, tomatoes in containers, has more challenges. Now, you mentioned blossom end rot, and blossom end rot is where the end of the tomato opposite the stem, so where the blossom was, starts to rot, gets sunken, that kind of thing. And that's caused by a calcium deficiency. Now, you mentioned putting lime in the pot, and lime does contain calcium, but typically there's enough, whether you're growing them in the ground or in a container, typically there's enough calcium in the soil, but there's something that's keeping it from getting into the fruit. The one thing that causes that is uneven moisture, and that's worse in containers than it is in the ground, because containers dry out not just from the top, but they dry out from the side. And so even on a really warm day, you get home from work, that pot is dried out already, you water it, everything seems fine, but those extremes of dry to wet, interferes with the plant's ability to get calcium to the developing fruit, and that's what causes blossom end rot. Another thing that causes calcium to not get to the fruit is cool temperatures. So we usually see blossom end rot on the first fruits of the year because those are forming when the temperatures are still kind of cool at night, and that can be whether it's grown in a container or in the ground, and then the blossom end rot seems to correct itself as summer goes along because the temperatures are warmer. If it's in a container and used a fresh potting mix, that sort of a thing, you probably have all the minerals that you'd need in there. So if you're getting some yellowing on the bottoms of the leaves or some spots are typically going to be biological, meaning bacterial or fungal, and they form where the fungal spore landed, basically, will become a spot. And there's several, when we talk about early blight on tomatoes, there's a complex. There's usually several organisms going on there. If you have spots, it could be Septoria leaf spot. That gets on tomatoes a lot. And you might just be having more of an issue in your container versus your garden stuff because of the variety. Is it the same variety that you grew in the container that
yes,
you have in
the... Yes, it is one of the same varieties. It's a regular... It's not a smaller one.
Yeah.
In other words, we tried to get a big enough pot, and this is kind of an experiment.
Sure. Yeah. Sure. And that can be thing, you know, part of it, you know, the plant may have restricted root zones and stuff, so it may not be putting any energy into those lower leaves anymore because, you know, it's only got so much so much root zone. You might still have some early blight stuff going on in there. There's always a chance that there's some mineral deficiency, and if you could, fertilize your container or treat it with, a little bit of compost scratched in the top or something, that should take care of adding any of those trace minerals that, you might not have in there. The thing is that even if you do have spots on the leaves, on those lower leaves and stuff, I would pinch them off and remove them so that they're not serving as a source for, more infections.
Spreading it around, yeah.
And, if this was something that, once frost started coming, you would, just get rid of the plant. I wouldn't really worry about a little bit of yellowing leaves. But since it is one that you want to try to bring in and keep going for a long time, trying to remove anything that looks like it may be diseased. And if it's yellow because of a mineral deficiency, it's probably not serving the plant anyway. So removing that's not going to hurt anything. But again, if you can, maybe a little compost or a fertilizer that has trace minerals in it, that would, make sure that you don't have any kind of mineral deficiency. But, whether or not that would help would,
I don't think it's a mineral deficiency. I'm wondering, I had a question. You mentioned that blossom end rot often can occur because of colder temperatures in the early spring. I have never had blossom end rot in my straw bales. And I'm wondering if part of that is because the straw bales, when, the tomatoes go into those bales, it's pretty warm in there already.
Well, it could be. And when do you usually plant your tomatoes in your straw bales?
Oh, first of June.
And that's the thing. When spring comes, we're also anxious to get out into the garden. And, of course, we want that first tomato, that first ripe tomato on the block, right? But when we plant in, middle of May,
I learned my lesson there. I don't do that anymore.
and the soil temperatures just aren't warm enough yet. And so even though the plant doesn't die, and even if we don't get frost, the night temperatures are still kind of cool. The soil temperature is still cool. And that affects those plants' ability to take up calcium. And you're right. In a straw bale, that straw bale is going to be warmer, so you don't have a soil temperature issue. And if you're not planting until the 1st of June, especially down where you are, it's going to be warm enough in the evenings, the night times and stuff, so you shouldn't have any kind of temperature effect on your tomatoes there. But that is that is a concern when, you know, we're so anxious to get out there, and if the soil temperature isn't up there. I always, you know, I'm always trying to give gardeners ideas to put on their Christmas wish list because, you know, people always want to buy you gifts, right? And
sure.
They want to know what you want. So I'm always giving my gardeners up here ideas to put on their list. And the first thing that I think most gardeners should get is a soil thermometer. And they're not very expensive. And, you know, it looks like a little meat thermometer. And you can stick it down into the soil 4 inches down in spring and see what the soil temperature is in your yard. And the soil, how fast the soil warms up in spring depends on whether it's sand, silt, or clay, how much moisture there is, what the exposure is, all of those things. So making sure that that soil temperature is the right temperature before you plant is really, really important for your success. And with tomatoes, you want that soil temperature to be at least 60 degrees before you're putting those roots into it. And if it's cooler than that, those plants are going to kind of sit there and not really do much anyway. So it's better to wait. And the date is going to be different every year depending on what our spring weather is like. So having, Christmas is coming. So
sure.
Put that soil thermometer on your Christmas wish list.
Very good idea. And Doreen, thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. We have lots of callers online, and Rose in Rockford, Illinois, has a question relating to what we've just been talking about a bit. Rose, hi.
Hi. Yes, I think you answered most of my problems, but my problems are with tomatoes that are actually in the ground.
Yeah.
They were growing fine all until up about a month ago, and then the bottom leaves started turning yellow, and the actual stalks and stuff started turning brownish. So would that be a problem with my mineral content of my soil?
No, I think that's probably some disease. There were, early blight. Again, you know, we've got a couple of organisms going on. Septoria leaf spot gets on them. And these diseases are soil-borne. So do you mulch around your tomatoes?
Yes.
Okay. So that helps. The thing is that a lot of these will, they start at the bottom of the plant because the humidity is higher there. Okay. And so, and a lot of them will splash up from the soil and get started on the plant. But even when you mulch, you know, they can still hang around. That's why we want you to rotate your tomatoes in your plant families. So that would include potatoes and eggplant and that are in that same family. We want you to rotate them to different places in the garden every year so that you don't get a buildup of inoculum in the soil. But, you know, in a year like this, and I don't know, down in Rockford, did you say, Illinois? Your weather's been like. But in wet years, there's more of an issue with it. If it's drier but you overhead sprinkle, that's going to cause more of an issue. So anytime those leaves are wet or have high humidity, these diseases can get started. And typically when it starts at the bottom of the plant and works its way up, it's some of these fungal or these tomato diseases. And a lot of times, especially by this time of year, it's kind of a race. You know, it might work its way up the plant, but the tomatoes up at the top still form, still ripen, and,
right.
You know, and it kind of catches up about the time the plants all die for winter anyway. So,
right.
And like we talked earlier, if you use fungicides, they are a preventative. They're not a cure. So now that you've got yellow leaves going and spraying them with a fungicide isn't going to cure them and fix that. But it's kind of up to you whether it's late enough in the season to just play out the race here and hopefully still get a crop. But I doubt very much, especially if it's in ground and you have decent soil that you've, especially if you've ever added compost or organic matter to it, chances are you've got plenty of, you know, all the trace minerals and everything that you need. If you have any suspicion that that's the case, then you need to send in a soil test. And typically a basic soil test just tests for the pH, which is important because if your pH is way out of whack, too high or too low, it can affect the plant's ability to take up nutrients, different minerals and stuff from the soil. So you might have plenty of it there, but it can't be taken up because the pH is way out of whack. So you want to do a soil test about every 5 years. Make sure your pH is in the range. The basic soil test will test for phosphorus and potassium, probably probably tell you how much organic matter is in there. But you can always ask for other tests for all the other trace minerals if you have any reason to believe that you might not have something in there in adequate amounts and stuff. So, but chances are, with the symptoms you're describing, it's probably got nothing to do with minerals and nutrients. It's probably something biological, a fungal, a disease going on in your garden. And it's very, very common with tomatoes. You know, tomatoes are the most commonly grown vegetable by home gardeners. I think 86% of home gardeners grow tomatoes. They're also the hardest.
Yeah.
You know, they have more disease and disease issues and you know, temperamental things than any of the other vegetables. But, of course, you know, you can't buy homegrown tomatoes, so
no,
you got to grow them.
And thanks a lot for calling, Rose. By the way, I planted, I tried a new yellow tomato this year, and I couldn't remember the one I had last year that was so good. This one is producing really nice fruits, but not very good flavor. Do you have a yellow tomato that you recommend?
You know,
we
have a demonstration garden in River Falls, and we have been planting cherry tomatoes. So I don't know if you want a larger tomato or the smaller
ones.
But yeah. For the cherry, the smaller tomatoes, we've had taste tests out there. And Sun Sweet is like, oh my gosh, like cotton candy. I mean, everybody just
Sun
absolutely
Sweet.
Loves it. Yeah. And you know, there's Sun Gold, but Sun Sweet is even better. And, you know, if it were me, I would just get that one and slice them into tiny, tiny little slices. But, you know, the flavor of tomatoes can be affected by temperature. And really, we have not had a hot summer. And being a warm season plant, those sugars and flavors in tomatoes develop with heat. And so that might be part of it. You know, you might grow that same tomato next year and it has more flavor to it if we have more heat. You know, I think, you know, up in our area, we've only had like two or three days that have hit 90 degrees. And normally we have like 14 or something like that. So that might be part of it.
Could be, although my big boys are tomatoes are just delicious.
Are they doing
oh, yeah.
good, huh? You know, one of the things this time of year, a lot of like Master Gardener groups and other organizations will have tomato tastings where they will get in, you know, 30, 40 different varieties of tomatoes and slice them all up, and you can go right down the line and taste them. And I really recommend that people take advantage of those opportunities because that's how you tell what you really like, you know. And it's amazing how many different flavors, how different tomatoes can taste,
oh,
you know.
Absolutely.
A tomato is not a tomato by any means.
Well, Rose, again, thanks for calling from Rockford. Let's turn to Cheryl next in Verona. Cheryl, hi. Thank you for calling.
Hello. We moved into a house with a magnolia tree. And this spring, it developed a white all along the underside of the branch.
Mm.
And then it drops like black liquid kind
yeah.
of.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, that's you're not the only one, Cheryl.
Yeah, that's magnolia scale. And that's
actually
an insect,
yeah.
Yep, it's actually an insect, and they stick on the stems like that, and they have this kind of white coating on them, and that's a protective shell for them. So underneath that bump, and it may look like it's all coated because there's a lot of bumps kind of stuck together, underneath that bump is an insect, and it's a soft-bodied insect underneath there, and it's basically sucking the juices
magnolia.
Tree, okay?
Yeah.
Now, if you get it really, really bad, you know, it could have some effect on the tree, but chances are that it's not going to kill your tree. But for some reason, boy, magnolia scale has just been really, really having a good year this year, and it's very widespread. And then that sticky stuff that's coming out, well, you know, everything that eats has to excrete something, and so that's basically their poop, and you know, it's called a honeydew in a lot of cases, and it's just, you know, sticky sap from the tree that has gone through the insect, and it's kind of going down. And then that junk can start getting a sooty mold on it, and it can turn black and fuzzy and stuff. And you can have bees and flies and ants and stuff come after that sticky stuff. So it's kind of a mess. So the difficult thing is that it's kind of hard to control these scale because they have that shell over them. And so if you spray with an insecticide, it doesn't get through that shell to where the actual insect is. But everything, you know, reproduces and it's right about now, I think, P.J. Leash, entomologist, was mentioning just last week that they've gone into what's called the crawler stage. So it's basically where the babies come out, and they don't have a hard shell on them yet, and they're crawling on the stems. And that's a time when you can use insecticidal sprays on them and kill those crawlers. The other thing that you can do is to prevent them next year is to spray the tree with a dormant oil during like February or March. And basically what that does is you coat all the stems and it will suffocate them because they do get air exchange through that hard shell. And if you can coat it with this a dormant oil, that will suffocate them so that you don't have the problem with them next year.
We were just talking with PJ about that on the show just a few days ago.
Yeah.
Okay, well, we'll give that a try. So right now, do some spray, did you say, with insecticide, and then next spring, use a dormant oil?
Dormant
oil, yep. And that's about February or March that you would put that on. That, you know, can help with suffocating some of them. And it may not be 100% effective, depending on how hard the shell is, that sort of a thing. But, you know, because sometimes they can kind of build up on top of each other and have a lot. Some insecticidal soaps and stuff might help with getting those things under control.
There we go. Thanks so much for calling. Appreciate your call. We have so many interesting photos on our Facebook page right now. I'm encouraging you, if you haven't gone to our Facebook page, please go to the posts, recent posts, and take a look at it because there are some great ones. And we'll talk about a few of those. I'm Larry Mueller. Our guest today, Diana Alfuth, horticulture educator for the UW Extension in Pierce County, here for Garden Talk on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Thanks so much for joining us for this edition of Garden Talk. I'm Larry Mueller with Diana Alfuth, UW Extension, horticulture educator for Pierce County. And great to have her along. Join in with your own questions. You can email us at talk@wpr.org or post on our Facebook page. Lots of great photos right now on our Facebook page. And the Facebook page title is The Larry Mueller Show. That's where you need to go to get on. And if you don't have anything to post, by all means, go ahead and take a look at the photos because there's some dandies. Kelly sent a photo. She says, weeds. Their weeds got away from them. And she has an argument with her husband who says, just lay the weeds down in the garden. She wants to get rid of the weeds and get them out of there so that the seeds don't create a new crop of weeds next year. Where do you come down on that particular argument?
Yeah, I was just reading that poster during the break, and she is absolutely right. One of the things, the weeds got away from you. If they're flowering and if they have flowered and are setting seed, you really, if nothing else, just run the lawnmower over them or something to keep them from maturing seeds. Or otherwise, you're going to be, you know, pulling their children and grandchildren and great-grandchildren for years to come. If they flowered and you don't think the seeds are mature yet, they can still continue to mature if you just pull those weeds and, you know, throw them in between the rows of your garden or whatever. So you got to be careful. Some of them will do that. So if they're just starting to flower, you can pull them and just lay them down. If they've already gone through the flowering process, I would get them out of there. And, you know, you can put them on a compost pile if your compost is going to, if you're sure it's going to get nice and heated up and stuff and kill those seeds. But what you don't want to be doing is just letting those seeds hit the soil and you'll keep having them in the future. And, there's all kinds of, we could talk for hours, Larry, about weed control and using mulches and stuff like that. You're always going to have some weed seeds in your garden. And so it's a good idea after you plant to put down a nice thick layer of mulch, maybe use corn gluten meal as a pre-emergent herbicide, that sort of a thing. But yeah, if you
get rid of those weeds.
Yeah, I would I would say that she is right, and hopefully her husband is listening right now, and we're saying, hubby, you need to get those seed heads out of the garden.
Andy Myers sent us a photo of a tomato. It's just underneath that photo that Kelly had sent, and it's a tomato with sort of a weird growth coming out the side of it. Looked like a little finger or something.
Yeah. And, I can't say exactly what causes that, but it's not unusual. I have seen it before. And I think it's just a little defect in the growth rate of the cells at that point, part of the plant that, let it grow out like that. And, it's a funky looking tomato. And I'm glad he's got a picture of it because, of course, tomatoes don't last forever. But it's, again, something may have damage that developing fruit as it was first coming out, something like that caused it to do that. Otherwise, I'm really not sure what causes those weird little growths on a tomato.
Carl sent a couple of nice photos, one of his flower beds, and then another of his straw bales. He had 12 straw bales this year with tomatoes, onions, and beans. All are doing great, and he's planning on doing more next year. Well, His straw bales make mine look like pikers.
Oh, no. Your straw bales look great. And he doesn't have Margaret the plastic turkey overlooking it either. But, and straw bales have caught on. And they're really, they really can be good. But I seem to hear people either have really good success with them or really bad failure with them. And it is a little tricky. They do take a lot of fertilizer to combat that breakdown of that straw in there. And they do take a lot of water. And so you have to really keep up with that. And if you don't get enough fertilizer in there, the biggest thing that people end up with are yellow plants because they're having a nitrogen deficiency and stuff.
Oh.
But it's great to see when people have good success and it's a good solution for their situation.
Deb sent a photo of her tomatoes and she says, well, what's happening here? I've got tomatoes being eaten or chewed on 30 inches above the ground. Would chipmunks be responsible?
Chipmunks could be responsible. You could also, depending on what the damage is, and it's a little hard to see on the picture here, birds will do that. Woodchucks will do that. Woodchucks
Raccoons?
Can do a lot of damage. Raccoons can, although they tend to more likely pull the fruit right off rather than just chew on it on the vine. So it could be a variety of things. And, it's kind of, my suggestion is that you get a trail camera. And, when these things are happening, because you don't normally see the critter that's doing it, so it might be doing it out at night and stuff. If you can set up a trail camera and see what kinds of wildlife are coming through your gardens, because there are some other, not real common critters that can be coming up through there. And even mice and the native little rats and stuff can be going up there and doing that. Rabbits will take, will eat all kinds of things at times. So it's hard to say for sure what it is. And unfortunately, when it comes to wildlife, it's really hard to control the damage with anything other than putting up some kind of a barrier, some kind of a fencing to keep them from getting access to it. And when you're talking about little things like chipmunks and mice, that's harder to do than it is for something that's larger. But hard to say for sure what's doing it because several different critters could be doing it.
And Scott posted three photos, nice photos of his flower garden. And I don't know if you can see those right now, Diana. Beautiful flowers. He's asking about the purple flowers, wondering what that flower is. He'd forgotten what it was. And I can't myself...
It's- Yeah, it looks like it might be a type of amaranth.
Oh, yeah.
Like, you know, it's not
pretty.
Really blooming yet. It looks kind of like an amaranth. And the other thing is that, you know, it's hard to say for sure, but it could even be a type of coleus because they have bred so many different kinds of coleus.
Yeah, that's true.
That we... you know, can't keep track of them anymore. Lots of different colors. This doesn't have the variegation that most coleus does, but almost looks like maybe a type of an amaranth.
And one more before we move on. Mary Lee, just below those three photos, sent a shot of some flowers, beautiful flowers. They look kind of like coneflowers, but they're a bright pink.
I think it is one of the newer coneflowers.
I think so, too.
Again, just like, you know, the plant breeders are always busy because they're always trying to come up with something new that we will buy, right? And I think this is one of the newer coneflowers that has been bred. It has the center almost looks like a little zinnia, but then it has the ray petals sticking out the side that are typical of a purple coneflower. And, you know, purple coneflowers come in all colors, all kinds of colors now and shapes and sizes. So that would be my guess. It would be better to tell for sure if we could see the foliage on the plant. But I'm guessing it's one of the type of coneflowers.
And if it is, boy, I'd be tempted to get one.
Yeah,
to get some
that
of
is
those
a
are
very
really,
pretty,
really beautiful.
Very pretty flower.
Joyce in Menominee Falls, thanks for calling. We'll turn to you next. Thank you for calling.
Thank you. I have, our tomatoes are not turning red. We've had just a few red ones, but not very many. And my question is, what can we do to expedite the ripening of our tomatoes? Or if we can't do that, what should we do to keep them from freezing until they do get ripe?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. It kind of goes back to heat again. I know up in our area, too, the tomatoes just, there's a lot of green tomatoes sitting out there, and they're just not turning ripe. And I think it's just the lack of heat and lack of sun that, you know, with all this rain has come clouds. So as far as what you can do to expedite it, I really don't know that there is anything that you can do to expedite it. Now, the good news is that once we start getting in there worrying about frost and stuff, if the tomato is physiologically mature, which even though they're still green, they might be mature and internally be starting that ripening process, then when you bring them indoors and bring them into the warm house, they will continue to ripen. And people have different methods of doing it, wrapping each one individually in newspaper, for example, and that sort of a thing. But even though you have a lot of green tomatoes, you can continue to ripen them indoors once that time comes. But they might just all of a sudden all go poof and start turning orange here soon. I'm hoping that happens in my garden because I'm having the same problem. But typically it's just a temperature thing going on, and of course, short of, you know, putting a greenhouse over it to warm things up in there, there's not a whole
lot
you
can
do.
Not a lot you can do.
Yeah.
You know, I ate the last tomato from the garden, I think it was November last year.
Did you?
It didn't taste very good anymore, but it was bright red, and it took that long for the last ones to ripen.
Yeah, and you know what happens is in fall, as the tomatoes keep ripening, everybody knows that even though we haven't had a frost yet, the tomato flavor isn't as good as it is in the middle of summer. And that's because the nights are cooler, the days are cooler, the days are shorter, and so the sugars don't develop as much in there. So sometimes when we start getting to that time of year, it's actually better to pick them and bring them in and let them ripen in the warmer house than being outside at night, and you'll get better flavor that way. But, yeah, there's nothing like a midsummer ripe tomato out of the garden.
No, there sure isn't. Brenda, thanks for calling. Hello.
Hi.
What's on your mind?
Well, I have two really beautiful nine-bark bushes in my yard that we inherited when we purchased our house, so I don't know what the varieties are. And last year, one of them started to get really horrible, like super thick, fuzzy mildew on it.
Oh, you know, you're breaking up so badly. I'm having trouble hearing, but Brenda, but here we've got nine bark bushes, beautiful bushes, but now we've got mildew. What can we do to treat mildew?
Yeah. So if it's a nine bark, if it's a purple maroon leafed one, if it's pretty tall, if it's like an 8 to 10 footer, it might be Diablo. If it's smaller than that, it might be summer wine or a little devil. And they, you know, as far as the mildew, you know, like you said, Larry, I couldn't hear the description, whether it's on the leaves. It may very well be the powdery mildew, similar to what we talked about earlier with the bee balm, mm-hmm. and because they can get that. So at this point in time, this time of the year, I wouldn't do anything about it. But if this is something that this plant is susceptible to and the conditions, you know, if it's in a location where the conditions are good for it, you know, doing things like trying to increase air circulation so there's not as much humidity around it could help. Otherwise, you know, it's the again, a kind of thing where you have to treat it before the mildew, the white stuff shows up. So if those are the symptoms, otherwise, if it's not powdery mildew, if it's some other kind of symptoms, then she should call me and we'll talk about it.
Roger wanted to know if you should cut down bee balm now. Is it okay to cut it now? And if so, how short?
You know.
Or wait till spring.
Well, I'd probably just wait a couple more weeks because right now those leaves are out there. They're doing photosynthesis. That's making food for the plant, and that's going down to the roots to store for winter. So if there are still green leaves on it, if you really want to cut it back, you could cut it back like halfway, leave some leaves on there yet, because it's a little early to cut it all the way down. And depending on where he lives, north versus south, you know, there may be 6 weeks of growing season yet easily.
Yep.
And you want those plants to get as much energy and, you know, stored yep. and in the roots as possible.
Very, very good advice. Our guest today, Diana Alfeth. Diana is a horticulture educator for the UW Extension in Pierce County. She also teaches landscape design at UW River Falls. I'm Larry Mueller for Garden Talk here on the Ideas Network. Thanks so much for joining us for this edition of Garden Talk. I'm Larry Mueller, and really happy to have Diana Alfeth with us. She is a horticulture educator for UW Extension in Pierce County, also teaches landscape design at UW River Falls. And Diana, thank you so much again for joining us today. Really appreciate it.
Oh, I love being here. Thanks for having me.
Oh, it's a lot of fun always, isn't it?
It is.
We have many more photos up on our Facebook page. One I just have to comment on before we go on to a call. And Diane and Spooner will get to you next. There's a tomato that Luann sent that has, looks like leaves are
it's
growing out of it.
The seeds inside the tomato have sprouted. And
that's what happened.
Yep. And this is not... It's not common, but I've seen it before. And for, you know, nature has mechanisms in place with hormones and whatever else that keep those seeds dormant inside the fruit until that fruit, you know, hits the ground, rots, and then those seeds would sprout. But every now and then, for some reason, the seeds will sprout inside the tomato. And I don't know what her, what the history of this tomato is, but typically we see it on store-bought tomatoes that have traveled a long way. And then people like set them on their windowsill in their kitchen, and there's enough light going through the tomato. But those store-bought, those varieties of tomatoes have been bred to not rot because of the shipping and all of that sort of a thing.
Yeah.
And so the flesh doesn't start rotting or breaking apart, but yet the seeds will sprout inside the plant. So what she has are little tomato seedlings poking out of the skin of the tomato. And it does look weird. You know, if this is a homegrown tomato, I don't know what... you know, what broke down that dormancy of those seeds in there and caused them to sprout. But that's basically all that's happening. You know, the little tomato seeds are trying to grow.
She says, I expected to hear the Twilight Zone music.
Yes. Yeah, it's a freaky kind of a little thing going on in there. And, you know, again, it's nice to have a picture of that.
Diane and Spooner, thank you so much for waiting. Hello.
Yes, hello. I have a question about my tomatillo plant.
Okay.
I have one plant. It's very healthy. It's in full sun, and it has a lot of those, what I would call pods on them.
Mm-hmm.
But I have no tomato. They're all hollow.
Oh.
That's weird.
Okay. Well, that is really interesting.
I have them by my other tomato plant. And my tomato plants are doing fine considering the wet and cool summer we've had. But I was really hoping to get, a few tomatillas. And I've never planted them before, so I guess I don't know what to expect either.
Yeah, and not a lot of people grow them, and quite honestly, I've never grown them, so I don't have a lot of experience with them on, I'm really not, because in order for them to form the pod themselves, then we had flower, and I would suspect that we had pollination issues. They're not self-pollinating like tomatoes are, that I do know. So they do have to get, did you have more than one tomato or more than one tomatillo plant?
No, I just have one tomatillo.
Okay. So in order to set fruit, it may be a pollination issue that's going on. You need to have two plants there because they're not self-pollinating, like I said, like tomatoes are. But it's weird that you got the pods without anything inside, because I would kind of think you wouldn't get the pods.
Something should be forming.
Yeah, something should be
for me.
But, again, I'm sorry, but I've not grown tomatillos. I know we have some this year in our demonstration garden that we're doing up here because we grew a Hispanic garden and we put those in there. But
you know what? We may get a call.
Probably will. Somebody out there.
Somebody will know.
Is a tomatillo expert and will know. Like I said, it just seems
weird.
That to get the pods, and then obviously something didn't make the fruits actually form. But maybe the pods are just the shell from the flower, and it was just simply a pollination issue that they never got pollinated. Because you do need to have more than one plant.
So Diane, stay listening. We may well get somebody to. Call in with an answer, or somebody may post on our Facebook page later on as well.
Sure.
Which is also another possibility. Sharon in Green Lake wondered also about ripening tomatoes at frost time, and I kind of covered that already a little bit. Let's turn to Tom in Whitewater up next, I believe. Tom, hi. Thank you for calling. Oh, lost Tom, too.
Oops.
That's all right. We have open lines, by the way, at 1-800-642-1234. Here's some several Facebook and email questions, so let's go to some of those. Sandra emailed and wonders if you can get a test kit for residue of herbicides and pesticides. We are surrounded by GMO farmers and seem to be getting spray and fumes from their fields, which affect our apples primarily.
Mm. Well, I don't think you can. I know that there are some labs in the country that can test for some of that stuff, but it's a lot more difficult than you would think it is. And a lot of times, if you have symptoms, the damage was done long ago, so there's not going to be any residue left. So, and as far as like getting into your soil or something, it wouldn't be in any kind of concentrations that would be, something they can test for and stuff like that. But if you think you have issues with spraying overspray drift that's coming from a neighbor that's affecting your stuff, well, then you have a right to do something about that, and you can talk to the growers, you can talk to the Department of Agriculture, and you shouldn't have your stuff adversely affected, but. There is obviously, always the question of proof and all of that kind of a thing. And the thing is that as far as like GMO stuff, like if you have GMO corn or soybeans next to you, and they will plant them and then they will spray them once, usually with glyphosate to kill the weeds. Other than that, unless you get drift from that glyphosate when they get sprayed, there's really, it's not like there's anything coming out of those plants that's going to come over and affect your plants or anything. So, know, it gets touchy, but if you think that you seriously are getting drift and that's damaging your plants, you have a right to, you know, do something about that.
We have Courtney on Facebook says, my purple coneflowers are looking like they're burnt. Mm-hmm. Petals brown and crunchy on the outside. Middle cone seems quite dry.
That's fungal. You know, again, by this time of year. And interesting, I have some patches of purple coneflowers, and some of them look like that and some of them don't.
Yeah, but, me too.
But, you know, they are, you know, when you get a patch of purple coneflowers are beautiful, but they're weedy, let's face it.
Yeah.
And so they drop seed and they come up. So you get a lot of genetic variation in there, and some are more susceptible to it than others. But in most cases, that's a fungal thing going on. And this time of year, you know, there's a lot of ugly brown leaves out there.
There sure are. Well, here with a tomatillo comment is John from Little Chute.
Wonderful.
Hi, John.
Hi. Yeah, I've grown tomatillos for a couple of years now, and they take a long time for the fruit to actually set. So if you planted seeds in the garden in the spring, it just maybe way too early, because I start them in, you know, the same time I start my tomatoes indoors, and they're just now, I'm just now getting nice-sized fruits on the very bottom underneath. If she looks at the older, what she called, you know, look like little balloons, if under, the older ones grow up underneath in the bottom, and if she looks up under there, she might find a few surprises, but usually it takes a long time. So,
so
if you plant by seed, you're lucky to get them by frost.
Okay, so the husks are there, but the fruit just hasn't formed inside it yet.
Yeah.
Right. It just starts really small, and then it grows, and then you look up underneath, you'll see some that actually burst the skin and kind of fall on the ground. That's when you know they're nice and ripe.
Oh, yeah. That's when
and,
you know.
And that's what's happening in our demonstration garden, but we did plant it from a transplant, so that's a little bit further ahead. So maybe that's the case. And, you know, just like we talked about the tomatoes not ripening yet and stuff, you know, it's not been a real warm summer. So, and these are, you know, heat-loving plants as well. So that might be a thing where there's just a little more patience to go here.
Absolutely.
Thanks.
Yeah, thanks a lot for calling. Tom on Facebook says he adds calcium to his tomato plants. He has he saves his eggshells over the winter, put them in an electric coffee grinder until it's smooth as talc.
Yeah.
And then when he plants, he puts heaping tablespoon in the hole.
And, you know, and there are different ways to add calcium. But again, you may have plenty of calcium in the soil, but it's a matter of the plant being able to take it up. And again, that can be because of pH, it can be because of moisture, and it can be because of temperature. So if you have a calcium deficiency, then adding calcium in one way or another is going to help. But in most cases, it's not a calcium deficiency. It's just something else that's interfering with it.
Jeff in Greendale, thanks for calling. Hi.
Hi, how are you guys?
Great.
Good. My question is about tomatoes. Last year, you know, people in my neck of the woods in Greendale had problems with their with a blight or mold or whatever it was. It seemed to be a common issue. This year, my early girls and better boys are thriving, and my black cherry tomatoes are very scrawny compared to full and bushy like they've been the last 4 years. Have you had any other concerns about that particular type of tomato, or is it just...
Yeah, black cherry, I know, is a little more susceptible to botrytis, which is a brown, fuzzy, gray mold that gets on them. But you would be able to see that probably. But it's very possible you might have a low-grade virus in that particular in those plants. You know, it's kind of hard to say if they're just kind of stunted compared to what they normally are. It could be something like that going on.
Yeah, and I'm getting tomatoes. It's just I'm not getting as many in the plant itself isn't as bushy. and tall. So I was just curious. But yep. Everything else is fine. Thank you.
All right. Thanks a lot for calling. Mark in Madison. Hi, Mark. Thank you for calling.
Yes. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure thing. What's on your mind?
Well, when I planted my tomatoes this year, I planted about a dozen what we thought were beefsteak tomatoes. That's what the label said. And they're starting to get ripe, and I've noticed that one of our plants, the tomatoes are looking beautiful, but they got like a purplish tinge to them. And we have no idea what kind of tomato this is or anything. It got the size of a beefsteak, but I've never seen any tomatoes like this before. I'm thinking that maybe it got a seed got mixed up in the bunch.
That's a very good possibility. You know, typically if you buy seeds from a reputable seed company, they have been tested. That, you know, it's very rare that would happen, because that's a pretty serious thing if they don't have the correct thing in there. But the purpling could be caused by some other environmental things. You could have something goofed up nutritionally. You know, so this is where. Color discoloration and purpling could be a mineral deficiency or toxicity. I don't know if you've had your soil tested recently, if you know what your pH is, but if the pH is different. And then weather conditions, again, you know, I hate to sound like I'm always blaming everything on the weather, but of course that's what gardeners do when you have no other explanation, right? You blame it on the weather.
Sure.
But seriously, cooler temperatures or certain environmental factors at certain points in the development of the plant can also cause some different colorings. So as far as, you know, saying, okay, if this isn't what we thought it was, what is it? That would be pretty impossible for me anyway, because there are thousands and thousands of varieties of tomatoes. So it would be hard to say what it is. But on the other hand, it's probably still pretty tasty. And
yeah, go
that's
ahead,
really
eat
what
it.
Counts, right?
Absolutely.
Well, I mean, I'm having the best tomato crop I almost ever had for the conditions that we were having, but I just thought maybe it was like a different brand or a different kind.
Yeah. Well, it could well be.
Yeah,
could,
you know, and beefsteak is kind of a generic term in a way, too. You know, so it describes the type of tomato, not necessarily the specific variety. So the label may have been meaning a beefsteak type of tomato versus a specific variety. You know, it's hard to say at this point.
And thanks again for calling, Mark. Appreciate it. And just to kind of go along and support our caller earlier about who talked about tomatillos, Rebecca sent us a note on Facebook. And she just said, tomatillas will grow a large husk or pod before the fruit begins to grow. Your caller should keep checking the plants and may find that they are growing in the next few days or weeks. They aren't ready to harvest until the fruit is completely filling out the husk. And she says, I hope she has some success. So good enough. Then we have a photo further down. Thomas sent a photo of his artichokes. With gosh, got some great artichokes. And Thomas says, it's been a great year for artichokes here in Janesville. They're very cool. Wet spring seems to be good for them. Once the temperatures became hot, they stopped producing. So there you go. And then there's one here, Diana, of plums that Tim sent. You see this damson plum tree photo?
I'm having an issue pulling it up right now.
Oh, okay. So we'll have to. It's a really weird. I'll tell you what. It's a weird issue with the plum.
Okay.
It's covered with something, and it's shrunken. Okay. And
I got it up there, yeah. Okay, so guess what that is? It's fungal. plums will get that, and it could be brown rot. It's not plum pox. It probably is, and chances, and you can see the little dots on there, the little bumps, the little pustules. Those are fungal spores now that are coming off and sending off. And plums are pretty susceptible to different fungal things like that. So, again, nothing you can do about it right now. But I would get out there and pick those off because they're spewing out spores right now. And it looks like the plums next to it are pretty close to really being harvested there. They're nice dark color and stuff. So I would get the good fruit out of there as quickly as possible.
Lucy in Appleton, thank you for calling. Hi.
Good morning, Larry and Diana. I just wanted to thank Diana for her wonderful program today. The people in Pierce County are so lucky to have you, Diana.
Thanks. Oh. I really appreciate that. That's really sweet.
Yes, it's like I'm sitting in a classroom. I belong to the Master Gardeners in Outagamie County and do a lot of gardening, and all of the things you said were so true, and I learned so much every time I listen to you. I wanted to say something about the tomatoes. I have a mortgage lifter heirloom tomato in my garden that really showed the signs of blight. That would be the early blight. And so I did cut off all of the spore, the leaves that were not looking good. I went out to look just a little while ago, and so far it looks good. So all of the things you've been saying are so true, and just keep up the wonderful work.
Oh.
Gee, thanks for the call. I really appreciate that.
Lucy, thank you so much. And, you know, yesterday we had Rick Clemmie on the show, Diana, and he was talking about cooperative extension. I mentioned you were going to be on. And, you know, you and there are so many, we love having horticulture educators from Extension on Garden Talk because you guys have a wide breadth of knowledge. It's always amazing to me how many answers you can come up with that are right on target.
Well, and you know, and that's what we do on a daily basis is answer questions from people just like that are calling into the show, that call into our offices. And so we do see a wide variety of things, and we don't always know the answers, and then we look them up and we learn. So hopefully we can help the next person with those issues. And that's, you know, sure, we all have, you know, master's degrees in horticulture, but we also have learned so much on the job, and we love helping others learn through this show and through our jobs, so it's all good.
You know anything about hollyhocks? Terry's got a question from Fort Atkinson about some lacy leaves.
Well, of course, and those lacy leaves are typically caused by hollyhock rust, so unless she has Japanese beetles. So,
Terry, have you got Japanese beetles? Oh, we don't have... Terry's not there. Well, anyway, the hollyhock leaves look lacy, and it's...
Yeah, that's a very, very common thing. And basically, there's a rust fungus that gets on hollyhocks, and it'll cause little specks on the leaves, basically, in between the veins, and eventually that tissue will fall out, and then it leaves just the veins of the leaves, and that's what makes them look lacy. So very, very common kind of a thing. Again, hollyhocks are so susceptible to it. If you're going to treat for it, you need to treat ahead of time try to avoid it in the first place.
And Shelley and Manasha, just if you got a very quick question.
Yes, I'm just looking for some resources. I am trying to plant a school prairie on some open sites. We had a recent school construction, so we had an open area that I would like not to be grass, but I would like to be prairie.
All right.
My suggestion would be to go to, hear where you were, but by Madison is Prairie Nursery. And if you go to their website, they have one of the best websites for talking about how to establish a prairie. And it will talk about the site preparation, you know, getting rid of the vegetation that's there so that you're starting with a clean slate, how to plant, all of those kinds of things. They're a great resource, and that would be my first place to start.
Neil DeBole, Prairie Nursery.
Yes.
And Diana, thank you so much. It's been a great pleasure. We'll look forward to your next visit.
All right. I will, too.
All right. Diana Alfeth, horticulture educator from UW Extension in Pierce County. Oh, isn't she great? Does a wonderful job. Monday, the weather guys join us to talk about hurricanes, among other things, and then we'll talk Space Science and Engineering Center's 50th anniversary. Stay with us.